Kia ora, this program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Wellington Access Radio, make your voice heard.
And welcome to the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on air. My name is Victoria. I am an alcoholic and chairperson for today's meeting.
Hello, Victoria.
We open AA meetings with the Serenity Prayer, and I invite you to join me. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Excellent. So you're listening to the Alcoholics Anonymous meeting on air broadcasting from Wellington. So we are on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. This morning we have the Sunday, what's the name of your meeting?
Mirror My Reflections meeting.
Excellent. In the studio. So thank you for joining us. So AA meetings typically start with the preamble, which I'll read now. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Excellent. So I'd like to ask Chris to please read how it works. So this is from the Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book, pages 58 to 60.
Hi, my name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Kia ora, Chris.
Chapter 5, How It Works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates, they are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose, in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or ourselves. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one amongst us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C. That God could and would if He was sought.
Thanks, Chris. Andrew, would you mind please reading today's daily reflection?
Hi, I'm Andrew. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Andrew.
A universal search. Be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. Alcoholics Anonymous, page 87. I do not claim to have all the answers in spiritual matters, any more than I claim to have all the answers about alcoholism. There are others who are also engaged in a spiritual search. If I keep an open mind about what others have to say, I have much to gain. My sobriety is greatly enriched, and my practice of the 11th step more fruitful. When I use both the literature and the practice of my Judeo-Christian tradition and the resources of other religions, thus I receive support from my sources and staying away from the first drink.
Thanks, Andrew. So now we get into the sharing part of the meeting. So my name is Victoria and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, Victoria.
Awesome. So I always enjoy the daily reflection. So that's just a book of some excerpts from AA literature and thoughts from recovering alcoholics. And quite often there seems to be this spooky phenomenon that whatever gets read out that day is always touches on something that I'm dealing with or thinking about or feeling at the moment. And I always enjoy when there is something about higher power or kind of the spiritual nature of this program in a reading, because it's a good reminder, especially a good reminder of how far I've come. Sometimes I still get a little bit nervous when there's, you know, a lot of talk in a meeting, you know, of spirituality or a higher power. You know, sometimes I still feel inadequate, you know, not good enough. You know, do I understand these things? Oh gosh, why are we talking about God? You know, what are other people going to think? What if someone new comes in? What are they going to think? You know, because when I came in, I certainly didn't know what to think. And I just feel so lucky that my individual situation was that I had no prior experience of a higher power. So, I mean, when I came in desperate and knowing that nothing I'd done alone had worked when it came to stopping drinking, I feel really fortunate that I didn't have any kind of preconceived notions of a higher power. So it kind of allowed me to be open-minded. But yeah, you know, when I first came in, I had no intention of finding a spiritual program or higher power, or I don't know if I even had that much intention of staying sober for that long. I just kind of wanted the consequences in my life to stop. I'd come to this point quite young. I was 20 when I got sober. That's not the case for all of us, but, you know, everyone in these rooms has a rich variety of experiences, and this is mine. By quite a young age, I'd already kind of bottomed out in my drinking, and I just wanted to stop waking up with just this weight on my chest. That's probably the best way to describe how I felt, not only when I was drinking, but also when I hadn't drunk. I still was always filled with shame and fear and regret, and I always felt uncomfortable and on edge. And that was something that drinking did for me for a long time. You know, my drinking worked for me. It took away whatever I was feeling. You know, I didn't have to be myself. I didn't have to deal with what was going on. I just knew that all I had to do was take a few drinks, and then I would just feel that release and that comfort that comes with a few drinks when you're an alcoholic. And that was really all I cared about. And I just kind of chased that feeling until it caught up with me, I guess. So yeah, I when I look back, I don't really see the things I lost or the external stuff as consequences of my drinking, because at the time I didn't really care. You know, it's not like I was just always willing to put alcohol ahead of everything else. And, you know, if something else got in the way, I was pretty happy to hand it over. You know, I was pretty happy to let go of stuff so I could keep drinking. You know, no sob story for me. You know, I didn't see it as like, oh, I lost this and lost that. You know, I very gladly gave away stuff so that I could keep getting effed up, you know, so I could getting drunk and high. Yeah, how it started out for me, I was always quite an uncomfortable, anxious kid. I always looked for things outside myself to make me feel better. And when I was 15 and I tried drinking for the first time, it felt like I'd found my thing. It felt like I'd really found my niche, and this was going to, I knew this was going to be something that was going to be a big part of my life from then on. And at first it was so fun. It was so fun, you know. I had so many good times on alcohol. I don't think I would have kept drinking if it wasn't fun, you know. And there were parties, and it just provided so much excitement in a life that I thought was just terrible. I thought it was so boring. You know, I was in a semi-rural town, and I just thought I was so different from the people at my school, and I thought that I was destined for something greater. And I thought I was in my last few years of school, and I felt like I was just biding my time until my life started. You know, I was just waiting for my life to start. So having this kind of excitement of going to parties and hanging out with older people, that was really a really exciting time for me, you know, and there were a lot of good memories. But one thing was, right from the start, I could see that I didn't drink like other people. It didn't have the same effect on me, you know. My friends would, you know, have a few drinks, or, you know, sometimes you get really drunk at a party. But with me, it was this kind of compulsiveness to it. I found that once I had one drink, all that was really on my mind was getting another one, you know. Like, I wouldn't be focused on the person that I liked, you know. I wasn't really worried about what my crush was doing or what my friends were doing. All I really cared about was drinking, and, you know, do things like, me and my friends would be organized to go out, and we might organize someone to buy alcohol for us, and, you know, we'd split the alcohol, but then I would also get extra alcohol, and from whoever, some weird, creepy older brother we were buying it from, and then I'd also get a few beers from my parents' fridge, and then also ask them for a few drinks. So I kind of was already stockpiling. Like, I already knew what's going to be enough for other people is not going to be enough for me. So I already knew there was a bit of a difference there. And even before I hit my late teens, I was already My drinking was already starting to have consequences. I quite quickly let go of the things that I loved and the things that I wanted to do in order to drink more. You know, all of my passions, things I did after school, my grades, just everything just kind of slipped. It kind of just went out the window. But like I said, you know, I quite happily gave it up. You know, I was more than happy to party and not do much else. And the breaks really came off when I went to university, because all of a sudden I could buy my own alcohol. I was 18. There was no one around to watch me. And by that time, I also knew that I couldn't control my drinking. I remember when I first got to university, I made a pact with myself that I wasn't going to drink the first week I was there, because I needed to make friends with people. And I knew that when I got drunk, I couldn't guarantee that I was going to act well and make a bad impression on people. So I purposefully didn't drink for the first week I was there, made friends, and then once I had friends, I went, right, okay, now I can let loose. And I sure did. One thing about my drinking and one thing I've learned coming to these rooms is that the people, places, and things in our drinking all looks different. But one thing that I always hear is the way that we feel, you know, how we... You know, it's the inside that counts. For me, when I was drinking, there was just no guarantees. You know, that's probably the best way to sum it up, is that when I had a drink, I just could not tell you what was going to happen next. I never drank as much as I meant to. The consequences from my drinking were pretty extreme by the end. I got to the point where I couldn't hold down a job. You know, I'd been fired, and I dropped out of university because I couldn't attend it. I'd lost my health. I'd been hospitalized multiple times. I couldn't live away from home. I'd been kicked out of flats. I was living with my parents. I'd lost every relationship and every friendship by that point. I just got to this point where I was just emotionally, morally, spiritually, physically bankrupt. You know, I just had enough. And I'm very grateful. I was very lucky. I come from a family with resources and my parents, I was still close with my family, and, you know, my parents had money, so I could go to rehab. You know, a lot of us don't get that opportunity. We have to figure it out. So, yeah, I went to rehab, but the interesting thing was it wasn't enough. You know, I felt just as bad, actually, if not worse, not drinking than I was when I was drinking, and I didn't understand it, because at the time I didn't realize I was an alcoholic. You know, as an alcoholic, I have a drinking problem, and I also have a not drinking problem. You know, like, drinking was how I dealt with everything. So when I wasn't drinking, it really felt like life without anesthetic. You know, I was just like a raw nerve. I got to the point where I was just like, I was starting to feel all those feelings again. I didn't know how to deal with emotion, and I was uncomfortable, and I was just angry and on edge. I felt like my life was just as bad as before, but I couldn't escape it. One night, someone I was really close to in rehab killed themselves, and they were also an alcoholic who'd just been driven mad by, you know, being a dry drunk and just the insanity in their head. You know, they weren't drinking, but just the insanity of it. And I don't know, just in that moment, I guess it was my higher power, but I just had this thought of, like, that is going to be you. You need to sort this out. So I looked at a meeting, and the next day I turned up and I stuck my head in the door and I said, am I in the right place? And everyone laughed. I remember feeling really angry because I didn't understand, but now I get it. You know, not many of us come through those doors by mistake, you know. And I looked around and, you know, everyone wasn't, you know, an old man who just rolled out of the gutter drinking out of a paper bag. You know, there were normal people. There were young women there. There were professional people. There were people who looked happy, and, you know, it was confusing, and I didn't want to be there, but I wanted what they had, and I kept coming back, and people looked after me, and they loved me until I could kind of love myself. And by going through the steps with a sponsor, I was able to really clean up the wreckage of the past and try to do things differently for the future. And that's how I try to live today. And, you know, life is still really lifey. I'm still really discontent. You know, bad stuff still happens. I still have to get up in the morning when I don't want to. But the difference is that I have a chance now. You know, like if I have a bad day, I have a chance to make it better. And that was something that just didn't happen when I was drinking. So for that, I'm really grateful. And it's really nice to be in a meeting on a Saturday morning, not hungover. And I'll pass it over to Chris.
Thanks, Victoria.
My name's Chris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
I have a home group, Monday night, Big Book in Kilburnie, 7:30 p.m. I'm an alcoholic who doesn't need to pick up a drink today, and for me that's a miracle. I believe that I was born alcoholic. I grew up in a very violent, dysfunctional, alcoholic family. I was never going to be like my relations, ever. As soon as I turned 16, I was out of there. I was going to be completely different. But because I was an alcoholic, the first time I picked up a drink, on New Year's Eve, age 14, I tasted it. I didn't like the taste, but I liked that warm feeling going down my throat and into my stomach. I was with a group of friends, and all the kids were meant to be drinking non-alcoholic punch downstairs in the rumpus room. The older brothers had poured bottles of spirits into it. All my friends were going, "Oh, yuck, this tastes revolting." Yes, it did taste revolting, but the effect was amazing. I drank, I don't know how much, probably not a lot, but enough for me to throw up on the nice white rug and get taken home at about 10 o'clock and get into trouble. And that was the beginning of my drinking. By age 16, I was in the sixth form at school. I had, the year before, got one of the prizes at the end of the year for diligence. I'd worked really, really hard to get some subjects in school certificate. but yeah, my home life was chaos. My father was long gone, and my mother had four children to bring up on her own. My mother suffered from severe depression, and I had one brother in the Apuni boys' home. Catholic social services came in and took my sister to a foster home in Blenheim. She was only 8, and my other brother went to a boarding school in the Wairarapa. I was left with my mother, who was often suicidal. One day she tried to take her own life at Lyell Bay Beach and was taken away to a hospital in Palmerston North. And I had just turned 16 and I was left there by myself. I had some older friends and I started drinking and using drugs. I got expelled from school and that was the beginning of my descent to hell. The if onlys still come back into my mind, but I have to let the past go in order to be able to live in the present, and the only way that I've been able to do that is by working through these 12 steps and building this faith in a God of my understanding, a higher power that initially was a group of drunks. I'd go into a meeting and somehow people would be nice to me. They didn't ask me about criminal convictions. They didn't ask me if I drank today. They just said, "Welcome. Would you like a glass of water? Would you like a cup of coffee?" And they seemed quite friendly. I didn't want God because the old God of my understanding hadn't done anything for me. I tried so hard to be a good person. I tried so hard to be different, and for a while life was good. I could somehow manage my drinking, somehow. I did a hairdressing apprenticeship, you know, I lived and worked with heroin addicts, and I was a big drinker, and they'd comment on my drinking, and I'd say, yeah, but I'm not a drug addict. You know, there was always someone worse than me. I had a nervous disposition, so I had to take prescription medication along with alcohol, which didn't kind of work too well a lot of the time. I was in and out of the psych ward. Often I would be suicidal, and I'd come to, and I'd still be alive, and I'd be really disappointed. I don't feel like that now. In fact, sometimes I can hardly remember what my life used to be like. But every now and then, I'll see a woman begging for money outside New World in Newtown, you know, out of it, not really knowing what she's doing, dirty, unkept. And I will often give these women some money, ask them if they want something to eat, because when I was in that state, I was so grateful if someone would give me something to eat, because I just had to drink. You know, the disease is progressive. And what I got away with in my teens and my 20s and my 30s, I couldn't do when I was in my 40s. My first meeting was at age 28, at that same meeting in Kilburnie, which I go to every Monday now to give back what was so freely given to me. It was mainly older men, and there was a man who was one of the founding members of AA in Wellington. He was a big, tall man, and he had a big stick, and he'd hit me on the leg or over the knuckles and say, "Girl, just don't pick up that first drink. Girl, just keep coming back." I was terrified. I listened to other people's stories, and I think, well, really, you know, my life isn't that bad. But oh yes, it got worse. It got much worse. Yeah, I had my name in the papers. Yes, I spent time at Arahata. Yes, I was in and out of the psych ward, A&E. When I'd be admitted to A&E, it would come up on the computer, chronic alcoholic drug seeker. I was really pissed off that, you know, the computerized system could follow me. You know, it was much easier in the days when there were no computers. But that's just my alcoholic mind. Yeah, I don't frequent the same places I used to. 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm in bed asleep with my little dog. I do what's suggested, but I couldn't do that until I'd really had enough. Until the time I came to after having an alcoholic seizure, and I just thought, I can't do this. If I'm going to be alive, I really need to do what is suggested in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have to do it fully, and I have to put it first. And since I've done that, my life has got better. Not, you know, money-wise, or the handsome prince hasn't come and swept me away, you know. The weather doesn't suit me, this doesn't suit me, that doesn't suit me. But it's all, you know, stuff on the outside. On the inside, most of the time, I feel okay. I'm not filled with rage. I'm not filled with fear, remorse, and regret like I used to be. I mean, sometimes it comes back. And, you know, there's some people that still don't want to have anything to do with me because of my behaviour as an active alcoholic. And I have to accept that because I have to realise that I put myself in these positions by picking up that first drink. If I didn't have that first drink, which starts off the mental obsession and the physical craving for more, I don't have to drink. I have no mental defence against picking up that first drink. None whatsoever. So I've had to build up the spiritual defence. And it's worked for me and countless others. You know, I was a hopeless case. And just for today, if I don't pick up that first drink, it's great. You know, it's I have freedom. I have freedom to really go wherever I want to go and do whatever I want to do. I'm not chained down. You know, when I pick up a drink and I just can't do anything but drink. And it's a horrible life. It's dirty. It's filthy. It's just, soul destroying. I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be alive and sober. I'm grateful that Victoria said, could I come to this meeting today? And I said, sure, why not? Thank you for listening to my story, and we have a 24-hour AA phone line. It's 0800 AA Works, and there's an alcoholic in recovery on that phone, you know, 24/7. So if you have any questions, you want to know anything more about AA, you can always ring that. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Just a reminder, you're listening to the Alcoholics Anonymous Wellington meeting on air, and we're broadcasting on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM. And yes, if you or someone you know relates to what has been shared here today, we encourage you to get in contact. So there's the 0800 229 675. That's that. AA Works number, so 24 hours a day, sober alcoholic at the other end of the line. Also, we're online, so the easiest place to find a meeting in real life, or recordings of other meetings on air, is AA.org.nz website, so you can find a meetings list. We have meetings in almost every part of the country, in Wellington there every day of the week, so there is a plethora to choose from. And we also have previous recordings of this show if you can't get to a meeting. And now I'll ask Joel to please share.
Thanks, Victoria. My name's Joel. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joel.
Hi, Joel.
Very pleased to be here. Nice to see you all. Yeah, this has been a very good meeting and a good reading also from the daily reflections. I take from religion what works for me. I was brought up religiously. I had a grandfather who was a priest in an Anglican church, and that was all very good. The theatrics in front of the altar and everything was great. He looked a very powerful figure, but behind the scenes at home, he was a very formidable man, very impatient, dying of lung cancer, and as a young child, 10, 11 years of age, witnessing that, you kind of take on board that maybe religion is pretty scary. I was brought up to be very fearful of God. That was certainly hounded into me as a young one, that God is watching me all the time and that I will be cast into the jaws of hell if I do this, and this. And I did this, and that. So I was completely flogging myself with guilt and shame about the wrongs that I had done. And when I had found alcohol, I had that temporary relief, which evaporated all of that fear, anxiety, and inadequacy. It just went. And so I pursued alcohol from that point of, from 14 years of age. I decided that, yes, I wanted this relief more often. So I did well at school as well, just like has been mentioned earlier in this meeting. I excelled in school. I got prizes, a prize giving for third form, and boy, did I work hard. So I certainly had it in me. Alkies are not lazy people. They are perfectionists, and they strive the very best they can. But as soon as I was 14 the next year, and that was a different story. I wanted to excel in drinking. And, of course, the schoolwork fell behind, and I failed miserably at school. Left school without any qualifications and ended up working as a butcher, which I thought was excellent, and it is. There's nothing wrong with that. But the fun part was that I learned how to work hard, and I was a boy in a man's world,
and I felt like a man because I'd drink with these guys after work, and that's when it started to escalate and things started to spiral out of control. I got a young 17-year-old pregnant. I was in my 20s, and then there was, because of the religious background, I had the parental peer pressure to marry this woman. And just like you were saying in your opening, Victoria, I freaked out. I thought the thing that freaked me out wasn't so much the wedding and getting married, it was what was my behaviour going to be like on this momentous occasion. I knew that if I drank, I'd just completely soil myself, my reputation. Well, I could have done. That's right. So that's right. The unpredictability of events. I could never tell what was going to happen, and that was quite frightening. That's when the spiral started to speed up. It became a tornado just rushing through my life. So. Boy, I tell you, it's coming to AA has helped. I was 18, 19 when I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it scared me because it was a different world. We sat around a circle, there were banners and literature and people who were very friendly, which kind of scared me away as well. But I didn't come back until I was about 23, 24, and I also did a treatment up in Stratford, Taranaki. I dabbled back in AA again. And the irony is that the facilitator at the treatment centre wasn't quite sure that I'd gotten that message in that five-week program, and he invited me and another member of the group back next year, the year after. And I was all geared to do that. And then I busted, which means I slipped. I picked up a drink. I relapsed after 6 months of sobriety. And then I drank for about 5 months. I got entangled in another relationship. It just got so messy. The only best way to describe it, it was like going down the hill in a go-kart with no brakes. Inevitably, I was going to crash, and I did 5 months later. So I got real after that big relapse. I was yet again in A&E, being carried off in ambulances and wasting precious resources on my life, you know, poor me, getting stitched up again. And then I was at that turning point, as it said in that reading. I asked a higher power for protection with complete abandon. And that is the motion that set the wheels turning. That honesty was that alcohol had beaten me. I was powerless over alcohol. And I was going to do anything to stay sober. So in that pause, I thought, well, I was invited to go back to treatment, but I'm not going to. I'm going to give AA a go. And I had given AA a go. You know, I had one treatment. I had a chance to do another one, but this is what's worked. And I've been sober since 94, and I want to continue that sobriety. And I know AA doesn't like to get into controversy, but I think this is important. I received an email regarding an article in one of our national newspapers regarding a recovery model from the States which encourages alcoholics to control their drinking. And it has strategies. For example, before going out, you know, review your 7 weeks, where your head's at, which is fine, I suppose, but say no to shouts. That's one strategy. And another one, which is very peculiar, is to take a pen with you. Why do you take a pen with you if you want to control your drinking? So that every time you have a drink, you mark with your pen on your hand how many you've had. Then you can count the amount of drinks you can have. To me, that is, yeah. And it kind of went against the AA philosophy of giving life to higher power and total abstinence, which scares alcoholics, they were saying. Well, From my point of view, those people are either not alcoholics or they are alcoholics who want to still drink. And I know for myself that I cannot drink. I tried that in that relapse. I had two beers on that first night of that relapse. And I waited and waited for things to turn ugly, and they didn't. I thought, well, I can safely drink again. And I did for a couple of weeks or so, until I was back at the bottle store buying crates, writing out checks, going to other bottle stores because I knew my checks bounced, and it just went on and on like this, and I ended up in hospital again. So, yeah, total abstinence and the adoption of spiritual principles works for me, and it's kept me sober and happy and gives me hope, the hope that I never had when I was a drinker. I'm reborn again, and it's great. I have a healthy marriage, I have good work relationships, I keep my employment, I've got excellent relations with my family now, and I have a positive attitude, and that's saying something for a guy who just wanted to end it all. So every day is a new beginning. That's what I like. I love the 24-hour program, and I'll leave it for Andrew now. So thanks, Victoria.
Thanks, Joel. And I'll now ask Andrew to share. Just a heads up, I think we've only got about 4 minutes left.
That's right. Hi, I'm Andrew. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Andrew.
And, yeah, that's funny, Joel. I never went out with anything sharp because I would have either stabbed you or stabbed me, you know, going along and putting a little mark on my hand. It's just so bizarre. You know, I drank to get the answers, and what I found is alcohol never gave me the answers. It just took away the questions. I love being in meetings. I hated them when I first came in. I thought, why do I want to spend the rest of my life talking about something that was something I wasn't proud of, and you know, why should I want to share that stuff? But, you know, today I understand what it's all about and that it's not about me. You know, I knew I wasn't very important, but I was all I ever thought about. And I would steal your wallet and help you look for it. You know, I was that sort of drunk. You know, I did whatever I could to whoever I didn't care about, and drank because of it. You know, I didn't have a horrible upbringing. I had an amazing upbringing, and yet I'm still in the same room. You know, I had parents that loved me, but they knew deep down there was something that wasn't quite right with Andrew, and I knew deep down that there wasn't something quite right with Andrew, and I. Even though I had parents who loved me, I had sisters that loved me, and later on a brother that loved me, I never fitted in. I didn't want to be there. What they talked about didn't make sense to me. It didn't matter how much they told me they loved me. I thought they were lying to me. And, you know, I sought relief out somewhere else. You know, and that first relief I found was when I was 16 years old and I met my first drug of choice. Her name was Anne, and she did to me what alcohol would later do for me. And, you know, she gave me a purpose. She gave me love. She gave me a meaning. And for the next 26 years, you know, my life was managed. It wasn't managed by me, but it was managed by her. And, you know, we had a great life. We had kids. You know, we had a house and cars and boats and whatever, you know, I wanted, we had, and it wasn't until one day that, you know, I just figured this is not what I want, and the spiral started. You know, I went from a binge drinker to a daily drinker in a day, and, you know, over the next 18 months went about destroying my life. You know, today it's not like that. I came in very confused. I didn't want it. I did my best not to get it. But something stuck. And part of that was the humour. I hadn't laughed for a long time. People remembered my name. People hugged me. People said, keep coming back. And, you know, they are very powerful words. You know, keep coming back. Because no one ever asked me back. You know, people would stop inviting me to things. Because they were afraid. You know, they were afraid of what Andrew was going to do. And you know, today, you know, it's not like that. I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. I have kids scattered all over the world. Yesterday morning, I spoke to all three of them, and, you know, that blows my mind. I was at one stage there, those kids told me where to go. We're running out of time. That's enough from me. I hope you find what you need. I truly hope that you get that gift of desperation. And, I'll leave it at that. Thanks, Victoria.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks, everyone, for coming today, for sharing, and for those who are listening. As mentioned, there's nothing better than the real deal, so you can go online in any part of the country and find a meeting in real life. There's no barrier to entry, and you're not alone, and together we can recover. So we'll close the meeting with a serenity prayer. Thanks. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can.
The program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Thanks, New Zealand On Air, for funding the Access Internet Radio Project.